I trust that is the cry of our hearts tonight. Title of my message this evening is Nothing to Prove, Nothing to Lose. You can turn with me to the 22nd chapter of Genesis this evening. I'm going to look into an account here to set the stage for our thoughts as we tackle this subject. This account in Genesis 22 takes us back to the early days of the Old Testament, where the patriarch Abraham is walking with God in the promised land. And in this particular account, if we can set the scene, the tent is silent except for the rhythmic breathing of a household that's at rest. Outside, perhaps the Judean stars are cold and sharp, and Abraham is well aware. He can recall, he can easily remember that it was under those same stars that God had once told him, childless though he was, to count them as proof that God's promise that he would have a son would come to pass. And so for 25 years after that promise was given, Abraham looked up at the stars and he considered his empty arms and he said, God's going to fulfill that promise. He really, really will. Even though it seems like a biological impossibility, even though Abraham's 90 years old and his wife is old and it just doesn't seem like there's any possibility they could have a child, he hung onto that promise and he said, that's what God said. That's what's going to happen. And then God did exactly what he said he was going to do, and he gave them a son, he gave them happiness, he gave them joy and laughter in their newborn son. And for a decade now, since that had taken place, since the impossible had become flesh and blood in Abraham and Sarah's household, since the promise was eating at Abraham's table and sleeping in the next room, that had been fulfilled. Now, as this chapter begins here in Genesis 22, the child of promise, Isaac himself, is alive and well. And he's sleeping just a few feet away from Abraham. He's no longer a distant promise. He's now a breathing and dreaming son, deeply loved. He is the physical proof that God is the promise keeper and that he delivers on what he says. But on this particular night, God's voice comes to Abraham and he says this, and we want to begin reading here at verse 1. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt, the word is test, Abraham and said unto him, Abraham. And he said, Behold, here I am. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah and offer him there for a burnt offering. Now we can well imagine God's voice didn't come in thunder this time. It came in quietness, but I can also well imagine that it cut deep into the heart of Abraham. And God uses very interesting language here, and we see exactly what God is driving at, because God says, take now your son, your only son, the son of promise, Isaac, the one that you love. God isn't just identifying a person in this request. Seems as if he's doing an audit on Abraham's heart. He's tracing the map of Abraham's affections. And he's pointing to the center of Abraham's joy, and he's laying a finger on the boy who replaced a quarter century of longing. He's saying, that thing, that boy, that son, that one you finally have and that one you finally own, that one that you've sort of built your life around now, I want him back. And that question sort of hangs in the air. Which do you love more? The gift or the giver? And Jesus addresses this question in Matthew chapter 6, verse 21, those familiar words where he says, For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And I think it comes home to us tonight, brothers and sisters, how often our hearts are tempted to cling to something other than God. And it isn't just our trucks, it isn't just our bank accounts, it isn't just our well-stocked pantries or beautifully decorated homes, though those things often tug at our heartstrings. It's also our spouses or our children or our health or our reputation or our right to have our own opinion or our hopes and dreams for the future. These things can run very close to us and very deep in our hearts. And we are in the habit of being unaware when our affections cross into the habit of possessing. And we begin to hold tight onto things that we should hold loosely, and we begin to grasp things that in their own can move us away from God. So our first point this evening is the tyranny of ownership. The tyranny of ownership. Now, the tyranny of ownership means that so often when we possess things, it's very easy for them to cross over from being possessions to possessing us. If we treasure our possessions, we can so easily carry the weight of ensuring that our possessions are not damaged and our possessions are not lost. And if we treasure our families, it's so easy for us to care more about what they want than what is perhaps best, or to protect them in ways that don't allow them to learn the joy and maturity of assessing risk. If we treasure our health, it's easy for us to pour our resources and energy into something in increasing amounts when it is inevitable that our health will fail. If we treasure our right to our own opinion, then it's difficult for us to ever have the freedom to admit that we are wrong. It's easy for us to cling to these things, and ownership tugs at our hearts. And I'm not trying to suggest tonight that God doesn't give us gifts and that we can't rejoice in those gifts and we can't be thankful for those gifts and we can't cherish those gifts. I'm talking about crossing the line into our possessions possessing us. Jesus put it like this in John chapter 12 and verse 25, where he said, "He that loveth his life," which seems like a good thing, "he that loveth his life shall lose it, and he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal." And that's one of the most difficult lessons for us to learn in life. And I particularly recall to mind a difficult time that I went through. It was very hard for me to understand that lesson. But we'll get to that in a moment. First, I want to introduce our second point this evening. And our second point is the weight of pride. The weight of pride. Because not only do we fall under the possession of what we possess too often, we also can become easily crushed under the weight of our own pride, which is something that's very closely related. And there was a time in my life when my mental health was not that good, when I was struggling with feeling depressed, and I was struggling with feeling desperate, and I was struggling with temptation that I did not know how to overcome. But in my own mind, I said, I can't ask for any help. I can't tell anyone what I'm struggling with, because if I did, if I admitted my weakness, if I admitted my need, then my life would be over as I know it, because everyone would think of me as a failure. They would think of me as a person who can't handle life. They would think of me as a person who isn't worthy of any sort of respect. And the fact of the matter was, and I didn't realize it at the time, it was the furthest thing from my imagination. I look back and it seems almost ludicrous in retrospect, but I didn't realize that I valued my reputation more than I valued life itself. And I actually remember praying one time, and it didn't hit me at the time, didn't make any connection in my mind, it just seemed like an authentic prayer. I remember praying. I was coming home from school. I was struggling quite a bit, was trying to find my way. I forget if I was walking or driving, but it wasn't a very long distance. I was coming up the lane. And I remember praying this prayer, "God, I give my life to you. I want to serve you. I want to do whatever you have for me to do, but I just want one thing in return, Please don't let me lose my good reputation. That was my prayer. Now, it seems kind of silly looking back, but it was very real to me at the time. Somewhere down in there, I would have almost rather died than have people think that I wasn't all that I appeared to be. And that is the tremendous burden of self-conceit. It is the tremendous burden of hanging on to something that seems immensely valuable to us, but that is not in the proper order when it comes to placing God where we should. Now, Paul says, among many, many verses in Scripture, Paul says in Romans chapter 12 and verse 3, fascinating to me as he comes out of this whole theological discussion about salvation and how it works, that one of the first things he says comes as a result of someone whose life has been touched by God, is he says this, "For I say to every man that is among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly." And of course, that word soberly means in your right mind, thinking realistically, thinking the way things actually are. Thinking things the way God sees them. And it's fascinating to me that as sound as that instruction is, as wise as that perspective is, that he goes much further than that, and he shares with us in Philippians chapter 2 this picture of Jesus, some of my favorite verses in the New Testament. And he says there in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 6, talking about Christ, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God. Why would he? He was equal with God. There was nothing wrong with that. But made himself of no reputation and took upon him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. So we have the example of Christ, who could rightly have considered himself equal with God, but he didn't. He came down as the Father requested. He came down in the humble form of a man. He came down as a servant to mankind of all things. And he humbled himself all the way to the death of the cross. So in reality, if we were to think realistically about ourselves and our place in the world, God would definitely come first, wouldn't he? And our reputation and our praise and our possessions would come way down the scale somewhere. But the challenge for us is that so often we have not yet grasped the joy and freedom of letting go, the joy and freedom of possessing nothing. And I think that's what this account in Genesis chapter 22 so powerfully teaches us, though it's a very difficult account. I really have no idea, because we don't have any details here. I have no idea what battle Abraham fought that night. To me, it seems like a nearly impossible request, one in which you just have to say, "God, you can ask anything else of me, but you can't ask that one. There's no way." Now, maybe Abraham had fought so many battles with himself. Maybe he had stepped out in faith so many times that this was just another difficult decision and he was just able to step forward and do it. I don't know. But I assume that Abraham being human and Abraham being a father and Abraham loving his son, that this was a soul-wrenching struggle for him. And I know in my situation, which was certainly not parallel, that I fought and I fought and I fought and I said, "This can't happen. God, I don't care. It can't happen. There's just no way." And I personally got to the place where I had largely stopped eating and I couldn't sleep anymore. That's how good God is. He keeps saying, "Got to make the decision." You really do. And Abraham made the decision. We know he did, because in verse 3 it reads like this. "And Abraham rose up early in the morning and saddled his ass and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son and clave the wood for the burnt offering and rose up and went unto the place which God had told him. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said unto his young men, Abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac his son. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and they went both of them together. Wow. Just think about it. I am sure that for those days, ever since the request, all the way up until the very moment, I'm sure Abraham was thinking about and wrestling with how much he loved his son. I'm sure it really troubled him that he'd only had his son for these few short years. I don't know if he may have even wondered, what would people say, all the people I told about how God fulfilled his promise, what will they say when I tell them this story? But at some point, Abraham had surrendered. He had turned it over to God. He had realized the only way here, the only real choice, is to surrender to God. And at some point, he acknowledged that Isaac wasn't his. And that's one of the most difficult things that we ever do, is acknowledge that the things we cherish are not actually ours. But that was very helpful for Abraham, because at some point he recognized that if God was able to give him a son when there was no hope at all of him ever having one, that then God could certainly preserve or restore his son when there was no hope of saving him. We know that's true because the Hebrew writer talks about it. He says in Hebrews 11 and verse 17, by faith Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, and he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, whence he also received him in a figure. Because in essence, in Abraham's heart, his son had died and was restored to him again. So at some point in this wrestle and in this journey, and I have great admiration for Abraham, who got up bright and early in the morning and split that wood and loaded up the baggage and got his son and said, we are headed to Mount Moriah, son. But at some point, Abraham decided that if God was able to give a son to two people who were as good as dead and certainly unable to have children, that he was able to raise his son from the dead, if that's what was required to fulfill his promise. God was the giver. And whatever he wanted to have happen is what would happen, because Isaac really belonged to God. And that is the conclusion that we struggle so hard to reach. What about us? It just seems like there's so much that has to go right in order for us to be happy, in order for us to be provided for, in order for all the bases to be covered. It just feels like we must have respect from other people. It just feels like we must have friends who surround and love us. It feels like we must have sufficient money to pay our bills and to meet our needs. It feels like we must have a good job. It feels like we must have a loving partner. It feels like we must have children in our homes. It feels like we must have good health. It feels like we must have the freedom to do what we want. It feels like our dreams have to come true. God and his gracious goodness to us, though it doesn't feel like it at the moment, God and his gracious goodness to us brings us to places in life, crossroads in life, where either we must decide that these good gifts are from God and they're under God's control, or we must close our fist and draw away from the presence of God. Those are the two choices that we wrestle with. Do we destroy ourselves by hanging on to the bitter end? Do we argue with God, hoping he'll change his mind? Do we resist his attempts to draw us closer? Are we able, like faithful Abraham, to surrender and say, God, oh God, I know that you're good. I know that your purposes are good. I know that you're working all things for good. I don't see the good. But they're the gifts, and they're from you. And I didn't deserve them in the first place, and I didn't provide them for myself because you're the one who gave them to me. So if you want me to have them, you can work it out. And so I'm going to lay it all on the altar. I was reading a story about a young lady by the name of Lilias Trotter. And interestingly, I had never heard of her before, but that had nothing to do with how valuable her efforts were. But apparently, as a young lady, she was a very, very talented artist. And she was thought of as a rising star in the art world. She was working under John Ruskin, who was sort of the pinnacle of art in that area and time. And he looked at some of her work and he made her this promise. He said, if you devote yourself to a life of art, I will see to it that your name is immortal. That's what he said. And of course, to a young lady, that would be very powerful words. And he wasn't the only one who felt that way. There were numerous other people who said, you are so gifted. But for this young lady, there was another voice that was speaking to her. And she wrestled between the two, but the voice that she heard was a voice that called her to missions in North Africa. And so for months she fought this battle. Was she going to continue her pursuit in the art world with all the glory and hope and future that promised? Or was she going to throw that all away and go to North Africa, where she just felt this strong pull on her heart to be involved in the work there? On the one side was the right to her own future and her own brilliance and her own talents, a legitimate claim to a career that would surely be the envy of the world. Many, many, many a young person has dreamed of and sought after being famous or popular or immortal and has not reached that goal. But on the other side was this call that she couldn't get out of her mind and she couldn't get out of her heart, to go to Algeria, where she knew nobody would see her paintings. She wouldn't be famous. She'd be completely removed from the circles of high society. But on one spring day in 1888, she finally reached a breaking point. And she wrote in her diary, "Today is the day of the great death of my ambitions." She turned the ownership of her life over to the Creator, and she said, "Lord, if you want me to lay down my brushes, if you want me to go to Africa, if you want me to leave the galleries of London and go to the streets of Kasbah in the Algiers, I'm willing. I'm willing to do it." And when she finally boarded that ship, she found joy. It was almost as if a burden was being left behind. She had nothing left to prove to the art critics. She had nothing left to lose to the world. And she spent the next 40 years of her life pouring it into those forgotten, broken people that had been laid on her heart. And she died in a small room there in Algiers, looking out at the mountains. But she discovered that the true beauty, the true blessing, lies in following the path that God outlines. And sometimes it works this way, and sometimes it works sort of a different way. There are people who've had dreams of going to foreign mission fields all their lives, and the door is shut. They end up doing something else. But the lesson is the same. Now that can feel, in some ways, I think, very heavy. It can feel very sad. But fortunately for us, the story is not over. We'll go back here to this passage in Genesis chapter 22, and we'll start reading again at verse 10. And Abraham stretched forth his hand, and he took the knife to slay his son. And what happened? And the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here am I. And he said, Lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thy only son, from me. Jumping down to 15. And the angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of heaven the second time and said, By myself have I sworn, saith the Lord. The Hebrew writer refers to this. God wanted to make this promise so sure that he swore not by anything lesser, but by himself. And he says this, For because thou hast done this thing, and hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in thy seed shall all nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. What an ending. You know, the deception that the devil tries to squeeze into our hearts and minds is that God is trying to rob us of the things that are good. That he's trying to take away the things that make us happy. But that's not true. God's purpose is to break our grip on the possessions and pride that are destroying us and dragging us down, so that we can be truly free and we can experience his blessing and we can be part of a plan that is bigger than we could possibly comprehend or imagine. Abraham didn't even see the end of this promise. I wonder if Abraham had been able to see a little further, if it would have been almost more joy than he could hold. Abraham, in the line of the Messiah, bringing salvation not only to the Jews, but to the whole world. The salvation story of humanity over all time. If we could only see it. I sometimes meditate a little bit on Job, and I think, Job, poor Job. Of course, Job understood that God was God and that he had the right to do what he chose to do by the end of the book, and he did receive blessing. But did Job have any inkling of an idea of how many thousands and millions of people would be blessed by the experiences that he went through? God's plan is just so much bigger than we can even think of. We hang on to our little wishes and our little dreams and the things that seem important to us, and God understands that, and he gives us good gifts, and he's not trying to harm us, but he wants us to open our eyes to a bigger picture. And so many times people will come up to me and they'll say, Joshua, I'm trying to serve God, but there's just one thing I'm missing. Maybe it's I've tried and I've tried and I still haven't found a girlfriend and I don't see how my life can go on. Or we've rented for years and I keep wanting to buy a house, and every time I think I've got some money together, something comes up.
Or I've always wanted to be successful in business, and I see other people being successful, and I've got this little business I'm trying to run, and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. I want something good, and God won't give it to me. And I have to tell them, I understand the struggle. I was there. I probably had a worse case of that than most people. But the one thing you're missing is actually the only thing you really need, and it's what God is asking you to give to Him, and that is surrender. Because nothing else will work. Surrender. Open your hands. Give up your grasp. Let God fill you with His gifts. It is only when we possess nothing, when we have nothing to prove, when we have nothing to lose, that we're truly free. That we can have peace with the Almighty God. And so my third point this evening is the freedom of surrender. The freedom of surrender. Because God blessed Abraham with one of the greatest promises of all time, but it came in the context of surrender. When Abraham was walking up that mountain, he was afraid he could lose everything. But when he was walking down that mountain after having given everything to God, he had his son, he had a relationship with God, he had a bright future. And that's how God works. When I turned my reputation over to God and said, God, okay, if you want it, you can have it. I'm just going to have to ask for help. I don't know what else I can do. God didn't take my reputation away. He broke my grip on it, but He gave it back, tempered by Himself. We think that by possessing things, we're protecting things. We think that if we hold on tightly enough to what we have, we can keep it safe, but we destroy it. Talking to a father one time years ago, and I was urging him to please let his boys get involved in a volunteer service opportunity. And you know what his response was to me? He said, Josh, there's no way I can do that. I have a business to run. If I didn't have my boys working for me, how will I ever make this business successful? After my business is a success, I'm fine if my boys help out in volunteer service. Do you know what happened? His business was a success. And his boys have plenty of money. But none of them are Christians. None of them are serving God. None of them are happy in their lives. How did that work out? I met another man. He was trying to run a business too. And it was a business that required a lot of manpower and a lot of manual labor. But he had a different view on life. And he said, I would like if every one of my sons could have opportunity to be involved in volunteer service. I want to encourage them to do that. Do you know what happened? His business struggled some. He ended up hiring some people that really weren't all that much help, barely able to do the job. That was years ago. Do you know where things are now? Every one of his sons is a dedicated Christian. Every one of them is hardworking. Every one of them is well provided for. I'm not trying to draw rules here. I'm just painting a little picture. God's purpose is not to destroy us. His purpose is to change our gaze from things that are passing away to things that really matter. He's happy to give us physical blessings. He gives them to us every day. He just doesn't want us to think that we are the ones responsible for providing all the blessings. He wants to give us a freedom of soul that we couldn't experience while we're hanging on to the things of this world. Just think about it a little bit. What makes a better parent? One who's constantly worried about their children and following them around everywhere, making sure they never bump themselves or scratch themselves or get hurt or have any disappointing friendships. Or one who has some sense of assurance that God is there, and even though they're wise and careful, they let them learn some things. What makes a better marriage? One in which two people are desperate for the companionship of the other, totally dependent on their partner's encouragement in order to make it through life, constantly afraid that their partners are going to cheat on them or they're going to lose them somehow. Or a marriage based on the calm trust that God has brought us together and He can continue to support us as we face the challenges of life. What makes a better church life? A pastor always has to be right, who becomes defensive and argumentative anytime someone challenges him, or someone who's humble, a congregation of humble people who are willing to listen to each other and hear each other and accept correction if needed and calm in the knowledge that God is at work in His church. And of course, it's the same in our personal growth. The one who has nothing to lose is free to confess his faults and his shortcomings. And his humility serves as a positive example to others. While the one who holds tight to his pride and to his reputation just continues to struggle and be trapped in the bondage and failure of sin. And I freely admit, I have spent way too many sleepless nights in my life worrying about all the things that could go wrong and all the things that I hold on to. But that's not God's purpose. That's not God's plan. That's not the freedom that He's trying to bring us to. And Jesus gives us those kind words in Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 and 29, when He says, "Come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls." That's His message for us. What about you this evening? What are you carrying tonight that's become too heavy to hold on to? What is it that's weighing you down? What is it that God's speaking into your heart and calling you to that you're reluctant to let Him have control of? I don't know what it is, but you know what it is, because God makes it clear what it is. And so tonight, the invitation is simple to each one of us. If we're tired of the tyranny of ownership, if we're worn out from defending a life that was not ours to control to begin with, then we come to Christ. We accept His easy yoke and His light burden, and we find the freedom that He offers. If you need to stop gripping what God wants to sanctify, if you need to surrender pride and admit need, if you need to stop performing for a world who doesn't care anyway, if you need to rest in the love of the Father, that's the invitation tonight. The invitation to live a life in which there are no regrets because all is surrendered to God.